Okay, well, I'm going to get started now. Hithati, nakas h. Dos hisse, haba. Nanatna, hinane, dosinta, epe. Hithati. I greeted you in my language. My people are commonly known as the Arapaho, Northern Arapaho. We are plains people. And I said, good morning, ladies, and good morning, gentlemen. My name is Te Ba'e. I'm Hinane, what we call ourselves, Hinane, meaning merely the people. Many tribes refer to themselves as people of the earth, people of the stone. We weren't called by what we are commonly called today. My people don't even know what Arapaho means. Mm-hmm. It was a label that was put upon us. Mm-hmm. And I live at a place called, they pronounce it Hithati, but that's not the correct pronunciation. It is called Hithati, which means good. And so I come from a place in Wyoming on the Wind River Reservation called Hithati. I am of the warrior clan. I should say society because we don't have clans. I was introduced into the warrior society when I was a young man, the Kit Fox Warrior Society. And we were probably the last group of young men to be introduced into that society. And as a result, I don't know if we have any more young people that were introduced into that society. To my knowledge, there has not been a ceremony like that since the last one I was involved in. Let me backtrack a little bit on my name, because I think it's very important, because it'll tie in with what I'm going to talk about this morning. My name, Date Ba'e, means strong old man. And that was the response I got when I was a young man from people when I would tell them my name. My brothers had names like Big Bear, Sitting Eagle, very romantic names. And I had a name that was not an animal name, but a people's name. Strong old man. And that name was given to me by my great grandfather, Charlie White Man, who was a captive. He was non-native. And he was captured as a young baby by the Ute Indians, and was given or traded to the Arapahos as a baby. And so he never knew his parents. Nobody ever knew who his parents was. His parents were probably killed in a massacre. And they didn't kill children because children were innocent. They didn't know what they were doing. They would take the children and raise them as their own and usually give the child to somebody that had lost a child or someone that had no children. So my great-grandfather, Charlie, this was about 1870, in that time period. He passed away in 1954. I was born in 1947. So as a child, I was very sickly. And I was not expected to live to be a year old. And so my great-grandfather, who became a spiritual leader amongst our people, a Sundance leader, he became a tribal councilman. He was a leader of our people, along with my grandfather from my mother's side. They worked together, and so he only spoke Arapaho. He spoke very little English, even though he was not. He was not native. We would adopt non-native people into tribes at one time, but that has changed because of the government requiring native people to prove their identity today. We are the only people in this country that have to prove our identity and the degree of blood that we have. Nobody else has to do that. I carry a card in my wallet that has an enrollment number and my percentage of blood. So my grandfather had a ceremony for me. And in this ceremony, he gave me this name, Strong Old Man, so that I would live for many years, that I would be a strong old man. And as a child, I was embarrassed at that name because people chuckled and laughed when I told them my name. I would say my name very quickly. So I had this fear that I wasn't going to live long as a child. 10 years old, I'm still here. 20 years old, wow. 30 years old, 40 years old, 50 years old, 60 years old. That name means something. That name has a significance. That ceremony has a significance. Those brothers, Strong Eagle, Big Bear, are no longer here. They're gone. But I'm still here. I come from a family of 5 boys. Out of that, there are only 2 of us left, my youngest brother and myself. So I do believe, I always tell people that I will be here for a long time, so get used to me. So, and part of the warrior, I am a Vietnam veteran, but part of being a warrior, being introduced into the warrior society, is not that you are a fighter, necessarily. You're not, that's not what a warrior is. A warrior is a person that is compassionate, loving, kind, caring. You take care of your people. You take care of your family. You think of yourself last. That's what a warrior is. And last, you will defend your people. So it's not about fighting. It's not what a warrior is. We have that today in modern society, we think a warrior is a fighter. No, that's the last thing you do, is to fight. You have to be all these other qualities to be a good warrior. You have to be honest. So we at the farm have young people that we consider warriors, but they're called garden warriors. Let me talk a little bit now about, I just introduced who I am and a little bit about what I do. I'm an artist. I think I mentioned that earlier. I did art for many years and then I became an educator. And I now work with young people, still an educator, but I do what I love to do. I raise food, and I teach people about food. I grew up on a ranch, and we always had a garden. I grew up with gardens. I was in 4-H as a kid. I had a project. When I was in college, I had a garden. So gardening has been a very important part of my life. It's nothing new to me. So I began working with Dream of Wild Health, and it's an organization that was started in St. Paul by a couple of people, John Eichhorn and Sally Ogier, his wife, had this vision, and they had worked with recovering people, native people. They had a male and a female halfway house. And they realized that part of the recovery was healthy food, that they needed good food to recover. So they rented some land in Bloomington, Minnesota. And they realized that this land was not the appropriate place. It was not large enough. So they looked around and they found this place in Hugo, Minnesota, 10 acres of land, farmland. And to this day, that's where we are at. We now own the land. We are an organization called Petawakan Teepee. We are not associated with any tribe. We are our own organization. We are a nonprofit. We have a board. So it allows us a lot of freedom to do whatever we need to do to make it work. And I'm very thankful for that. You know, we're not politically affiliated with any organization but ourselves. So they started working with young people. And in the beginning, they didn't really know how to set up the program, but they knew they wanted to involve kids and they wanted to raise food. So they started this program. And as time went by, realized that educating the young people about healthy food was very important, because diabetes is rampant in Native community. Obesity, heart disease. And so by teaching the young people how to raise food, how to eat healthy, and how to cook the food was part of the program. And that's what we still do today. I am the cultural director at Dream of Wild Health, and my job is to work directly with staff and with the youth, and I teach the culture. I make sure that every element of what we do pertains to Native culture, whether it be gardening, whether it be just sitting here having a discussion. Every morning I begin the day with the young people and the farmers in a circle. And in this circle we smudge and we offer sacred tobacco every morning. And I lead a prayer, and that's how we begin our day. We get centered. And from there, we begin our day, and we end our day in a circle. The circle is part of what we teach, the concept of a circle. And in Native culture, the circle is a very important part of whatever we do. We look at everything in this circle. So when I was a kid, when people said, think outside the box. Why did you get in the box in the first place? You know? There's no need for that. I was given an example yesterday about this circle of life, because, you know, if you look at the earth is round. The earth moves in a circle. It rotates. The planets rotate. The moon is round. The seasons go in a cyclical fashion. Your DNA is in a circle. So we think of everything that we do in a circle. Everything is combined in a circle. Every living thing is in a circle. We're just a small part of the circle, you know. I was talking yesterday about how in contemporary culture today, how we look at time. For example, in your lifetime, you're born right here. Your life continues across in this linear fashion. It's about half of your life. Three quarters of your life. And this is where, how interesting the Bible is here. This is where you pass on. So look at the distance from where you were born to where you go when you pass on. Now, in the Native culture, and everything revolves in a clockwise fashion in this circle. We are born here at the 12. Our life continues quarter of the way, halfway, three quarters. We're getting older here. We got gray hair. We pass on. So life and death are back to back. There's no separation. And that's why we always say that kids, babies, and older people, elders get along very well. And they look alike. They're wrinkled. They have no hair, no teeth. They're very similar. So that's the way we look at this circle of life. Everything is encompassed in that circle. Our seasons, whatever we do is involved in that circle. So this is one of the teachings that I pass on to the young people, the circle of life, and how we as people are connected. We're connected to what is above us, what is out there, what we call space, what is here, where we walk, what is under the ground, and what is in the water. We are all connected, everything. We are all part of that. We are all in this circle of life. And if we get out of balance in some way, it affects everything. And we all know that today. We are feeling effects of things being out of balance. There's many things today, and as many of us know. And so these are some of the teachings I teach the young people. We have two programs. We have a program called Chorus Kids. Chorus Kids is the young people from 8 to 13 years old. They come out there for a week. We introduce them to farming, planting seeds, compost, a lot of the basic skills of farming. And then we work with the older students from 13 to 18 for a month at a time. We do sessions with them, which is more in depth. And they actually work. It's like a job to them because they get a small stipend. They have to show up every morning. I'm there every morning to pick them up. I've been doing that now ever since I worked there at the farm. And I was telling the kids that I have yet to miss a day in over 9 years, and I've never been late. I said, I have to set an example for all of you. So I said, I've never been late or I've never missed a day in that many years. I said, I'm there every day to pick you up and bring you to the farm. So if I can do that for 1 month, you should be able to do that. If I can do that for 9 years. So, a little pressure on them, you know. But so, we teach them job skills. They have to be there. They have to report for work. They have to come to work. If they miss a day, they get 1 day excused, unless it's a doctor's excuse or a ceremony. After that, we tell them, you know, we have a waiting list. And if you don't want to be here, you don't have to be here. We will replace you. So we used to recruit students, but now we're getting a reputation as being a good organization that works well with youth, that teaches our youth. We have waiting lists now. We have at least, this last year, we've had over 40 students for each program on our waiting list. So that's a vast amount of students compared to when I first started. I used to have to go to the schools and recruit students, you know, to come to the program. So we teach the kids how to raise food. And one of the things that I teach them is that, you know, we talk about organic farming. Well, organic farming is nothing new to Native people. Permaculture is nothing new. They're just words that people use today. We have been doing that for generations. But what we're doing is we're reintroducing you. We're reintroducing you to these methods because new methods have been forced upon us. New ways to raise our food. And so I talk about the history of our food, the history of our people, and how we got to where we're at today, and why we have so much heart disease, why we have so much diabetes. And so I go back. I'm also a historian. I used to teach Native American history. And somebody said, well, how do you teach Native American history? I said, well, I said, first of all, I had to study American history. Then I deconstruct American history, and I reconstruct it and present it from a Native perspective. Because rarely is history written by the defeated. History is always written by the victor, and it's glorified. And so Native people have never had a voice in history. Even our children have had to learn a distorted perspective on their own history in the school systems. And history begins in 1492. There was nothing here before that. So the history books say. So I teach a history that goes back over 10,000 years. Pre-Columbian history. And then I move it up to now, to today's history. So part of that history that I teach the kids involves what happened. What happened in 1492? What changed? And why did things happen to us the way they are today? So one of the things that I talk about is that we, as Native people, were probably, you know, we look at other countries and we kind of look at them in a bad light. For example, we look at Hitler as being a very bad person. And I'm not saying he was good or bad, but people say, well, he committed genocide. Look at all the Jewish people he killed. But this country never looks at themselves. This is what happened here in this country. 50 million Native people. Cultural genocide. And that's one of the things that you don't read about in your history books. See? It's never looked at. So I teach the kids some of these historical events that happened so that they can understand why and where we're at today. So when they tried to wipe out a culture, Native culture, 50 million of us, there were survivors. They couldn't completely wipe out Native people. So they said, let's look at what do these people rely on? What is important to them? What keeps their culture going? What keeps them going? The buffalo. The buffalo gives them food, gives them shelter, it gives them clothing, and it deals with their spirituality. All those elements. If we wipe out the buffalo, then we can wipe out a lot of their culture. So let's go and we'll hire mercenaries. They were called mercenaries at the time. That's another modern. To go out and slaughter buffalo. The same people that we hired to wipe out the natives. And these are people that, and this is one of the only countries that honors their killers. I see places when I travel, Kit Carson, for example, used to kill Native people, used to kill buffalo. In Arizona, they got a big museum, they honor him, you know? So they went out and tried to exterminate the buffalo. They were almost successful. The last remaining herd is in my home state of Wyoming in Yellowstone Park. And they're still trying to wipe out the buffalo. The ranchers in Montana and Wyoming do not want the buffalo to come back because it could replace the cattle, the domestic cattle. And so they kill the buffalo. If they wander out of the state park, they will shoot them and slaughter them yet. So this is what I term nutricide. It's intentionally bringing about death by nutritional manipulation, by exterminating the buffalo, by clear-cutting the land, and even monoculture agriculture. Because you're trying to kill somebody. You're trying to kill people. So you implement all these things in order to get rid of them. Well, when that didn't work, when the buffalo were almost all gone, the natives were still here. So let's put these people, let's isolate them. Let's put them on reservations. Let's take them away from their homeland. People don't realize that many, many native people are displaced in their own land. My people lived here in Minnesota, in the Red River Valley, at the headwaters of the Mississippi. We were allies with the Dakotas. We lived here before the Ojibwe people, hundreds of years ago. But we were nomadic people also. And we became people that roamed. We followed the buffalo. We migrated with the buffalo. And we became what is called Plains Indians, living out in the West. So, once we were placed on reservations, then we were not familiar with the land. We couldn't raise the crops that we were used to raising. We didn't even have the seeds anymore. The seeds were gone. And so the government said, we will feed these people. That's where it started. They gave them what was called rations, which consisted of lard, bleached flour, and sugar. Now, if you have people that have been eating berries, that have been eating vegetables, that have been eating lean buffalo meat, this changes your body chemistry drastically. So native people invented fried bread. Have you ever had fried bread?
Last night.
See? That's a product of that food source that they gave us. That's not a native food, but today it is. It's a contemporary food, and it's not healthy. So we've had to live on that diet, and they still give what they call commodities, and which are still very bad. And so we have, as a result of that, generations on that food. Of eating that kind of food. It's like alcohol. We never had alcohol. We didn't know about alcohol. Alcohol was introduced to our people in a very bad way. Alcohol was brought in to native people by whiskey runners. And what would happen was that if they got drunk, we could get them to sign a piece of paper. They wouldn't know what they signed. We'll acquire their land. We'll take their furs, whatever. And so this whiskey runner would come in so that he would not be caught. He wouldn't have been caught anyway because the government supported what he was doing. But he told the native people, you have to consume this alcohol as quickly as possible and as much as you can as quickly as possible. So if you're introduced to alcohol in that way, you learn how to drink that way. You drink until you're intoxicated. You drink as much as you can, as fast as you can. That's the way we were introduced. And I had a professor when I was studying Native American studies, Dr. Dave Edmonds, who's written many books, would share his research with me, and he found a recipe on whiskey, Indian whiskey, they called it. And what it was very bad whiskey, a small portion of very bad whiskey that they couldn't sell, or they wouldn't sell to people, and they would mix it. They would mix it with wood grain alcohol, which can cause you to go blind, or go crazy, or die. And strychnine. And chewing tobacco for color. Now, the strychnine, if you lived, made you very sick the next day. And so what the native people observed was when they would watch the non-native people drink, usually it was a cavalry, they would drink and they would shoot off their guns. They would get wild. They would get crazy. And the next day they would be sick. That's what the strychnine did. It made them sick the next day. So they thought, oh, we must have had a good time. We raised Cain last night and we're sick today. So this was how we were introduced to the food and to the alcohol. So you pass that on to your children. Your children pass that on to their children. And they wonder why alcohol is such a problem in the Native community today. So these are some of the things that we don't learn about in our history books. We don't know about these things because they've been suppressed. They've been suppressed. And so in order for we as Native people to recover from this trauma, intergenerational trauma, we have to understand our own history. We have to understand what got us to where we're at today. And I would say you can't recover unless you know what you're recovering. You have to know what you're recovering first. And so these are some of the things that I have to tell. They're not pretty. But they're true. They're historical facts. I one time was accused of being an activist, which I was, or a militant, which I was, but an angry one, which I was. And I thought, you know, I used to read history and I would get very angry. And history used to put me to sleep. But now history keeps me awake. That's all I read is history. And I don't agree with all of it, but at least I can be aware of things in time that have happened. So by understanding a lot of the history, then I can begin to teach what I need to teach. You know? And the food is a very important part of that because it relates to the culture of our people and of many cultures. Food is very important. So with the food on the farm, we have ancient seed, old seed that was gifted to us by a Potawatomi elder by the name of Cora Baker. Cora Baker spent her lifetime in collecting seeds. She collected seeds from every tribe in the country, old seeds. Her whole life was spent this way. But she could not find somebody that she could pass these seeds on to in her lifetime. Somebody that was serious enough. And she always said that teach the children. Show the children how to grow this food. Teach them, and they will grow the food. Well, she heard of our organization before she passed on and gifted us all this seed. And so we are the keepers of this sacred seed. And I tell the young people, these seeds that you are holding in your hand are the only tangible things that you have from your great, great, great grandparents. Mm-hmm. because those seeds have been handed down and we have them to this day. So we have to treat those seeds like they are our ancestors, because they are. You protect them, you treat them with respect, and you grow them. And so the kids are the warriors. They are the garden warriors. They have to have all these traits to take care of those seeds and to raise that food. And with that food, with those seeds, we have songs. We have songs that go with the planting. Whenever we harvest, we put down our sacred tobacco, because we give back to the earth when we take something. We don't just take and keep taking without thanking. We must first thank and put our sacred tobacco down. The tobacco that we put down is over 900 years old. And that's what I was doing yesterday when some of you were out there. I was working on this tobacco. It's very sacred. There are four plants that the Creator gave us that are sacred, that we use. The sage, the sweet grass, the cedar, and tobacco. And so the young men helped me raise the tobacco. That is their obligation. And while we are raising that tobacco, I teach them about their role as a young man, their responsibilities to their family, their responsibilities to their people and the community. That's why it's not that we're separating the male and female. It's that it allows you time to be with the young men. The women also have time to be with the young women, to teach them their roles, to show them what they're supposed to be doing. A lot of these things are absent today in our culture. Many tribes don't practice those things anymore. So these are some of the things that we are recovering. These are some of the things that we are showing our young people. You need to do this. The earth is in trouble. The water is not clean. The air is dirty. We've desecrated the earth. So we have to learn a lot of the traditional ways and bring back the traditional foods, the plants. I was taught that if we do not use these seeds that were given to us, they will leave us. So with this tobacco that I raise, one of the things I've noticed is bringing back the native bees. The honeybees that we have in this country were imported here. They're not bees from here. There were bees that were here before that. And so by putting in these sacred seeds of this tobacco, genetic memory is what these insects have. They are coming. They come to these plants. I've never seen them like that. Swarms of bees. Many different kinds of bees. Bees that I've never seen before. They come out of the ground and they're coming back. So I know that by raising this tobacco, by raising this traditional source, this traditional medicine, even the foods, even the insects, the animals, they know. So, if we start looking at these things that are important for survival, then we look at, well, what do we need? We need the land. We need the air. We need the sunlight. And we need the rain. We need this water. So we not only have to take care of these plants, we need to take care of all these other things also. because they are all connected. And we are only a small part of that, we as human beings. We play an important role in raising those foods, but if you think about it, many plants, many things don't need us. The earth certainly doesn't need us. It'll survive without us, but we need all these things as human beings to survive. So, by looking back at the culture, by looking at what Native people have always done, we as Native people and people of the world, we need to start making changes. We need to start looking at things in depth. We have to start looking at the water. What can I do as one person? How can I make a change? I can't change everybody in this room, but I can make a change starting with myself. I can conserve water. We teach the kids how to conserve water. We don't allow them to go to the bathroom in the farmhouse at all. We have a porta potty. Because I teach them, if it takes 5 gallons of water for you to go to the bathroom each time you go, let's say you go 2 times a day, that's 10 gallons of water. And how many students do we have? 15. That's 150 gallons of water a day that we're saving, we're conserving. So, every little bit, everything, the land, we teach them how to take care of the land, how to protect the land, to take care of the animals. We don't allow them to kill insects. We don't allow them to pull up the grass, pull the leaves off the trees. You have to honor those things around you. You can't just take them. If you want that leaf, you have to ask the tree, then you have to make an offering. If that tree says, no, I don't want you to take my leaves, then you don't take it. You don't just pull the grass up. You have to make an offering before you do that. So we teach them respect. We teach them how to respect not only human life, but other life. And respect is very important. We respect our elders. That's one of the things in today's culture, they're just old people. I've heard people today say that when you get old in this culture, you're ignored. You're invisible. Nobody sees you. That's when you should shine. In a Native culture, that is your role as an elder. I was telling them yesterday there are two types of people when you get older. There's old people and elders. Old people are grouchy. They don't teach anything. Elders are grouchy and they teach you something. And that's what I want to be. That's what I am, an elder, you know? And that's part of the traditional way is that we as elders have to pass on our knowledge and our wisdom. Because somebody gave it to me. I didn't just one day, you know, start knowing things. It was given to me. People passed it on to me. Now, as that elder, I have to share that information. I have to share it with people. That way, they too can pass that knowledge on. That's part of Native culture, what we've always done. We're an oral culture. We teach by talking. I had an aunt that used to tell stories. She was a storyteller. She would come to the house, and she'd tell us stories every night. I'd fall asleep. I'd wake up in the morning. I'd hear her talking in the kitchen. Doesn't she ever sleep? You know? But she was always telling stories, and that was her role. She was a storyteller. And in these stories, there are teachings. There are teachings in every story. And that's why they repeat these stories over and over. They want you to know these stories. Because there's teachings in them. That way you can pass them on. Well, I think my time is about up. I could go on and on and on, but I'm going to stop now, and if there's any questions, I'd be more than willing to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, and we still have 15 or 20 minutes until folks need to start heading down for lunch, so please do engage.
What's that?
Said we still have about 15 or 20 minutes before they have to head to lunch, so
there's
time if folks have questions or there's anything else.
Okay.
So. Tell us a story.
Well, you know, my co-worker, Diane Wilson, who's a writer, was sharing something with me. That she had written, and it's very well written. She's a very accomplished writer, but it was something that that happened on the farm, something that was very moving, something that was very touching to all of us. We were gifted seeds from the Lower Sioux, the Dakota people. And these seeds were corn. And so to our knowledge, this corn had never completed its cycle since probably the late 1800s, maybe early 1900s. And so what we did last year was we had the little kids, chorus kids, plant the seeds. So I instructed these young people how to do it. And they had to plant 6 seeds in each mound, a little hill. And so these kids went out and they started planting these seeds. And we stood there and watched them do this. And it was a moving time, because we don't even know when was the last time our ancestors planted those seeds. And to see these kids come and plant the seeds. And we finished. Hope Flanagan, one of my co-workers, who's very, very knowledgeable about plants, she forages. We learn about medicines. We learn about all the plants. She sang a song before we started planting. And this is what we do. We sing. We sing to the earth. We sing to the seeds so that there's this movement that starts. The kids then planted the seeds. We finished. There was one thing was missing. And one of the kids, a little girl, started doing it. She started dancing. And she started dancing like this. And one of the people there said, "That's an ancient dance. Even the Mayan people do that. What they do is they have a person, what the kids just did, that dances and they're putting the seed in the ground. And then along behind them, this person dances. And what they're doing is they're putting the seeds, patting the seeds. And this child knew that, taught us how to do that. She brought back that. And I talk about genetic memory of the insects. It's also in the people. And it was very moving to see this, whole cycle, the song, the dance, the kids planting. So what we did, took that corn, and we made a flour. And we made a bread out of that corn. We made a cornbread. An ancient cornbread. It's much different than the cornbread that you eat today. Mm-hmm. The one you eat today is so bright yellow. Mm-hmm. You know? This one was not that bright, but it was more delicious. We had our corn measured at one time, a few years back, and it was so pure that it was off the scale and antioxidants and everything. I couldn't measure it. Mm-hmm. So we have to protect this corn from Monsanto. Mm-hmm. All our seeds, we have to be very cautious about them. So what we do is we raise these seeds and we store them until we can get enough. Then we will distribute them to various native tribes and organizations that will also protect them, protect these seeds so that we can have them for future generations. So these kids are part of that. We're restoring all that again. We're bringing it back. But with the young people, these are the ones that are going to be our leaders. They're the ones, that's what I would say. At Dream of Wild Health, we raise vegetables and leaders. They're the ones that are going to be the future generation. I was reading statistics because of the food that we eat today, that our kids will probably not live as long as we do. They will have a shorter lifespan than we have. Think about that. That's pretty sad, what we're giving them. So if we can start giving them this wisdom, this knowledge, this way again, we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. We're giving them a longer life, and we're showing them how to do it. So this is one of the things that I see, that I experience out there by teaching what I teach and seeing it work. We have one young man who started with us when he was in Chorus Kids. He spent 7 years in our program. He worked his way up. He became a leader. He became 18 years old. He was the first one. One of the first ones, we do a small scholarship. He received a scholarship because he was going to college. He's now in his second year of college at Augsburg. He wrestles at Augsburg. We hired him back this past summer as one of the workers as staff. He attributes a lot of our program to where he's at today and where it got him. So I take him under my wing and I train him because I know that he's going to be a leader. I've seen him grow. And that's what we do as elders. We watch. We watch those young people that have that potential. Those are the ones you give responsibility to. You also give to others. But those are the ones that you see that are going to be the leaders, and he's one of them. I was telling him, I'm not going to be here forever. I may be a strong old man, but I might have to quit working one day and spend some time for myself. You're going to have to take over. So, you know, we look at this young person that was dancing. We look at the young people that were planting the corn. And here's a little excerpt from her writing here. When we care for our mother, when we raise healthy children, returning to these old ways will help us transcend the trauma of the past as well as that of the present and provide healing for our ancestors. When the blood memory of our children remembers the green corn dance, that is a rhythm of the heart calling us home. So, and I have seen many things, you know, in my time, and I think that what we do at this farm is one of the things that guided me in my life to where I'm at. I've done many things in my lifetime. I've been many places. I talk to the kids about some of the things that I've done in my life, the places that I've been. I've traveled all over the world. My art's taken me to places that I never thought I'd be. I was just this young boy on a reservation. And I never dreamt that I would do what I'm doing. I never thought that I would be able to stand up in front of a crowd and pray and share with people my prayers. But I'm asked now as an elder to say prayers every day. And to me, that's an honor to be able to do that, you know. And I never thought that I would ever, ever, ever do that. So I'm very honored to be here today, to talk to all of you, to share with you, and just to respect one another as human beings. We all have a task, you know. We have, you know, I was looking at some of the brochure, and it talks about this being one of the largest watersheds, the Mississippi River. And, you know, water is very, very precious, and we don't realize it until we lose it. My reservation in Wyoming supplies about two-thirds of this lower part of the state with water. We have mountains, and so we have dams, we have snowfall. And in 1950, the Army Corps of Engineers began diverting this water, telling us it was for irrigation purposes on the reservation. Good. Well, they diverted water, and then they built a reservoir, a dam. And they dammed it. And then once they got all this in place, they turned around and challenged us for our water. We went to court. We lost. We have no water rights at all. We buy our own water. We buy our own water that originates on our own reservation. And that's an example of how precious water is and what's happening and what's going to happen. I always say this, and mark my word, there will be a day when there will be wars over water. Already in this country, Arizona and New Mexico are in courts fighting over water. Legal wars have already begun. There was a time when they would come in and they would buy the land. They were called land barons. You've heard that term. Now they're water barons, corporations that come in and buy your mineral rights and you keep the land. Because they've taken all they can from the land, but they haven't taken what's underneath. So when I say my prayers every day, that's what I pray for. What's above us, what we're walking on, and what's below. We pray for all these sacred things. And so these are our responsibilities. We have a responsibility. Native people have always known that. I always say if they had listened to us 600 years ago in our teachings, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in today. But nobody listened. Nobody listened to the teachings. There was great people at those times that would project or see the future. Prophets. And what is happening today was something that they'd foreseen. And Native people always knew this would come to this point because they had seen this. So I always say, no matter how bad it is, it's not too late. There's still hope. We still have hope. You know? We got ourselves in this situation. We can get ourselves out. So we all have to do that, though. We have to make a conscious effort, you know, in making changes and trying to do what has to be done, you know. So water is one of the things that you need to survive. We can't live off oil. You can't eat gold. Those resources are unimportant when it comes to living. You know, they mean nothing. You could have all the gold in the world. You can't take it with you. King Tut proved that. They still found all his gold in his tomb. Isn't the philosophy and teaching of the Egyptians, you take it into the next world with you? No, they found it in his tomb yet. So you can't take it. It's not that important, you know? And that's one of the things that I try to do in my life, and I'm still learning. We minimalize everything. Cut back. Not to consume as much. We live in a little RV that's 24 years old when we travel. So we're limited in what we carry. We're limited in our water supply. I might go a week without a bath. But I'm learning, I'm living what I teach. I don't drive a car. I drive my RV only when I travel and when I come back home. So I have to live what I'm teaching my young people. I eat healthy. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I teach them how to live healthy. Not that I haven't done that before, but I'm living this way. And this is the kind of life I have now. And so I have to teach the young people, this is how you can stay healthy, this is how you can be healthy. And then the statistics for the lifespan of an average Native male might even be gone down was 48 years old. 48 years old, can you imagine that? That's pretty bad. I've surpassed that, and I'm thankful. I have a brother that didn't make it. You know? I have another brother that just barely made it. They're both gone. So, I think that by what I do with the young people, and what I show them through my way of living, is I'm teaching them through showing them how it's done, what I do in my life, you know. I like to teach with love. That's what I say. You got to teach with love. And I tell them you got to cook with love, too. Whenever you cook that food in the kitchen, you got to put love in it. My mother used to always tell us, if you're angry, get out of my kitchen. I don't want anger going into my food. Because I don't want to promote anger. I don't want to feed people anger. So what I did, I've taken her teaching and I apply it to my art. I don't do art when I'm angry. I don't want to put negative things into my art. Somebody may come by one day and look at it and bam, it'll come out to them. So I don't want to promote that. I have to get my mind, my heart, everything in the right stage before I do art. Then I do it. It's the same way as cooking. So I teach the young people that. You can't be angry in the kitchen. Be positive. Put love into that food. And in the garden, there's no horseplay. There's no foul language out there. Because these are your ancestors that you're working with. So we're going to put good energy because they pick that up. Good energy will come out of that food that you eat. Science has proven that, especially with animals. You know, if an animal dies in fear, they know. Same with plants. So you have to put good energy into it. That's why we sing to the plants. You know, people talk to their plants all the time. There's nothing wrong with that. The plants like that. You know, are you crazy? You're talking to your plants? You know, no. They like music. They like us to sing. They like us to dance. They know that we're putting good energy. And they, in turn, will give us good energy. At one time, we used to have runners, messengers, that would run. They could run all day. They would deliver a message. They would come back. But every morning, one of the spiritual leaders, an elder, would gather all the runners. Each runner got a kernel of corn and put it under their tongue. I used the same method when I was in the military, when I used to march. I would pick up a pebble and it would keep my mouth moist. That way I wouldn't consume as much water. When you're dry, you want to drink water. But it served two purposes, this corn. They would put it in their mouth. They would keep it there all day. So what you're doing is you're getting that seed ready to germinate. So at the end of the day, they would come back and they would give that kernel of corn to the holy man. But you know what it also did? It picked up your DNA. Could tell what was wrong with your body, what illness was in your body. That plant would adjust so it would heal you. Now, people say, that's pretty wild. No, it's true. That plant knows. It can heal you. It can help you. So that's what they would do. That plant would grow. It would cure that illness, whatever it was. So maybe when you plant your seeds this summer, put them in your mouth for a while. Let them soak. Put them in the ground. It'll pick up what's in your body that needs to be healed. And that plant will make adjustments and help you. Native people have contributed a lot to the world. Pharmacology. Over 2/3 of the foods that the world eats came from the Americas. 2/3. If it wasn't for my brothers in South America, we'd all be asleep. We wouldn't have our coffee. The Italians would have a pretty bland palate. They wouldn't have tomato sauce. They didn't have tomatoes. The Irish couldn't brag about their potatoes. So all the foods that the world eats today came from here. So Native people have always been agriculture-based people. So this is what we're trying to regain because it was removed from us forcefully. Forcefully. Education was forced on us through boarding schools. Boarding schools have a very, very bad memory for Native people. So when Native people talked about education at one time, they didn't want their kids to go to school because of what their experience was through the education system. It was much like what I talked about alcohol, how that was introduced. It was the same way with education. They would take the kids out of the house, put them in the school for 9 months, little kids. And so there was a lot of things that happened there, really bad things. So when they grew up to be adults, they didn't want their kids to be educated because they didn't want them to experience the type of education that they had. So if you have generations of that, there's still a little hesitation about the education system and what and how it's taught. So I went to a school that my parents attended. It was a boarding school, but it was a day school when I went there. It was much different than when my parents were there. They were not allowed to speak the language. They were told that their spiritual way would only hinder them, that they had to take on this new way, which was Catholicism. I spent many years as a devout Catholic. I was an altar boy. I was training to be a priest at one time without my knowledge. I speak Latin. I do the old mass. So I got away from that because of all the harm that it had done to my people. I'm not saying that Christianity is bad. I'm just saying that that one experience for my people was bad. So I always tell people I'm a recovering Catholic. You know? And so I now practice my own way, which is of my people. You know? We had our ways long before Christianity came. And so it's kept my people alive and well, some of us, for hundreds of years. So I have that for my well-being. Each day I do my prayers, I do my spudging, and I begin my day. So, thank you.
Thank you.